Hi, this is Andrew, and this is Keynote, the daily now.tv chat show with some of the world's leading thinkers and writers. Hello, everybody. It is April the 1st, Monday, 2024. As always, I'm talking to you from the west coast of the United States, although the jokes in America aren't always very funny. A lot of people are fearful of the country's descent into civil war. We've talked a lot about that in the future. Next week, Alex Garland, a UK filmmaker, his new movie, Civil War, is coming out, a dystopia, a warning about how America may descend into civil war. In a couple of months, we're also featuring a book by the former BBC correspondent in Washington, D.C., Nick Bryant, one of the most respected foreign correspondents, entitled The Forever War, America's unending conflict with itself. We've done many shows, of course, on America's potential descent into civil war and the breakdown of American democracy. One man all too familiar with civil war is my guest on the show, Izmir Volic. He's a professor of math at Wellesley College and a Bosnian emigre, someone who left Bosnia as it was experiencing civil war and made his life in America. He has a new book out on perhaps the threat of civil war, or certainly violence and ways of improving democracy in America, called Making Democracy Count. Izmir is joining us from his office in Wellesley, just outside Boston, Massachusetts. Izmir, you were a young boy in Bosnia in the years before the Bosnian Civil War or the Yugoslav Civil War. But do some features of what's happening in America in 2024, do they remind you of that period in Bosnia and Yugoslavia?
Absolutely. First, thank you for having me on. It really is an honor and a pleasure. But yes, the indiscriminate use of populism, bordering nationalism, sort of questionable in election practices, all of that is very reminiscent of what was happening in the former Yugoslavia in the early 90s. Now, I was 16 and 17 when this was happening, and you know, all I cared about was, like, you know, the band I was playing in and, you know, like chasing girls and stuff. So I didn't really notice much that was going on around me. But now, you know, looking back and sort of thinking on those days, unfortunately, the parallels are many and scary between Bosnia, that descended into the most horrible war that Europe had seen since World War II, and some of the features of our political system today.
Izmir, a few months ago, we had one of your Bosnian compatriots, Alexander Heman, on the show, perhaps Bosnia's best known writer, novelist, certainly best known in the United States. He has a new book out, The World and All That It Holds, is his own love story, I think, to Sarajevo, as Sarajevo is a kind of Jerusalem. I'm not sure if you've read the book. It's a wonderful book. Heman's own story in some ways is like yours. He happened to find himself in America during the Civil War. Tell me a little bit about your story. How did you get to America?
Right, and it's funny that you mentioned Sasha. Sasha is a good friend. I know him well. We are both active as sort of, you know, professional academic diaspora. We're active in Bosnia and try to improve you know, that frail state. But like him, I found myself in the U.S. In the summer of 91, I came to visit an uncle who lived here in Boston, and it was meant to be a 2-month stay. But during those 2 months, the war in Croatia had already started. Croatia had seceded and Serbia had attacked it, and the Slovenia, a similar thing happened, although the situation in Croatia was more serious. And Bosnia was still, things were okay in Bosnia, but my mom had this foresight, and she said on the phone, you know, you might want to try to stay there, finish your senior year of high school in Boston, just kind of make it 1 year, see what happens, see where things go. And it turns out
you were at Somerville High School, right?
That's right. That's Summerhill High School, right? Yeah, exactly. That's my high school. And here I'm 33 years later. You know, I enrolled in high school. As I was graduating, April of 92, May of 92 is when the war started in Bosnia, lasted for 3.5 years. And, you know, I stayed here in the meantime.
Izma, you came to America as a refugee. You, I guess, in a sense, fled the war in Bosnia. In the early 90s, Bill Clinton was president. America seemed prosperous on lots of levels. How is America for you as an immigrant, someone who has in some ways embraced America and in some ways is critical of it? How has it changed in the 30 plus years that you've lived in this country?
Well, the most significant dramatic change, I would say, happened in 2016. And you and other listeners know what happened in 2016. But up to that point, I had never really felt different or as an outsider. Everyone I came into contact with sort of embraced me, embraced my, you know, origin. Sometimes even people were really felt bad for me because I was from Bosnia, and they knew what was happening in Bosnia. But no, at no point during my immigrant life here, up until 2016, did I feel like I was an outsider, like I was the other or something. But then that election in 2016, somehow things had changed. The air had somehow changed. I was suddenly aware of my accent when I speak. My last name, there's a little accent on the letter C at the end. Suddenly that looked strange to me. I noticed that in my American passport.
Yeah, I didn't put it on the lower third, but I should have. There's a little check mark over the C.
Volich, exactly. There's a little check mark. But my passport, you know, I'm a U.S. citizen, but my passport still says, you know, the country of birth, Bosnia-Herzegovina. And suddenly I was aware of that. Suddenly I was aware of my immigrant identity somehow, and in not in a good way, not in a way that made me proud, and in a way that wanted me to sort of share this heritage. I was borderline afraid for what was going to happen after the 2016 elections to people like me. So that was a significant change. I wouldn't say I was, again, it wasn't a fear. It was more like an irrational sense of sort of the air changing around me. And there were really no physical or actual manifestations of this fear. You know, I continue living my life just as I always had. I'm lucky to live in Massachusetts, which I like its policies and I like its political profile. So nothing really happened since 2016, but somehow things became different for me.
You head of the math department at Wellesley, a top liberal arts college. You also run the Institute for Math and Democracy. And your new book focuses on how math can help us repair our democracy, making democracy count. But I want to get into the book in a few minutes, Izma. But in terms of 2016, can we blame the American electoral system for the victory of you-know-who in 2016?
We can. Blame. I'm not sure that's the right word. But here's what we can say. Had the system been different, have the democratic processes, the sort of foundational algorithms that we employ in our democracy been different, the outcome could have been different, right? And the question is, you know, are those alternative systems better or not? And I claim that they are. So if we had used things like, you know, ranked choice voting, or if we had not had the Electoral College, right, things would have come out differently.
I want to get to ranked choice voting and your other analyses and critique of American democracy. I take your point. But on the other hand, surely it wouldn't have made any difference to the anger that many people, particularly on the right, but also to some extent on the left, feel about the historical, traditional institutions, political, economic, cultural of American democracy. No reform of the electoral system can challenge that, what one European philosopher called the resentiment driving so much anger and hatred and violence in America or any other society, can it?
Absolutely not. So mathematics is just one way that in which we can try to repair our democracy. I'm absolutely not claiming that this is the panacea for our, you know, all the political failings of today. But it is really it would be a powerful tool to reform some basic processes according to certain universal principles and truths, which, of course, you know, if you're looking for nonpartisan, logic, reason-based approach, then mathematics is really you don't have to look any farther in mathematics. And mathematics says certain things that we do, we definitely can do better, regardless of this whole, you know, baggage of history and the what did the founders intend, etc. So Electoral College, for example, is, you know, that it falls under the rubric of preference and feeling and relation to history and heritage. So some people say, I just like the idea of Electoral College because, you know, I like the Federalist view, even though the math doesn't check out. And that's fine. I acknowledge that. There's a lot more that goes into these things than math. But for ranked choice voting, for example, there's absolutely no reason why we should be using plurality voting or first past the post. There's nothing in the Constitution that says we should be doing this. No founder ever said we should be doing this, right? It is just plain old wrong method of, or an incomplete method of voting. So there are things like that that are really shouldn't be contested. There's no basis for their existence other than just sort of default inertia, you know, easy to use. We've been using it for 200 years. Why use something different, right? So those mechanisms, I think, should change and could change, and they are not subject to any kind of contentious politics or history.
Ismail, this is a softball question for you as the head of the math department at Wellesley, but do we respect math and sufficiently culturally, philosophically in our culture? We've done lots of shows on math in the past. One with James Zimmering. He's an interesting author. He wrote What Science Is and How It Really Works, in which he suggests that sometimes math distorts our thinking, but the ancients didn't think that. Pythagoras was thought of as a philosopher. Aristotle had a great deal of respect for math. Does math get the credit philosophically, ethically, that it deserves in the 2020s?
Well, yeah, I think it does, maybe on some level, some abstract level. When I say to people I'm a mathematician, they say, "Oh, that's cool." That, you know, there's an air of kind of respect or acknowledgement that this is something that not everybody does. That it's maybe hard for a lot of people, or they think it's hard for them. The question is of implementation. Do people actually listen to math when it comes to applying it to the real world? And that's a different story. So it's sort of like, yeah, math's great, it's cool, you're a mathematician, you're doing all this cool stuff, but you know what? I'm still gonna do things the way I did them, you know, always. And we saw this during COVID, right? Mathematics was really the tool to attack COVID, and it you know, saved millions of lives because we knew how to model the spread of the pandemic. We knew what flattened the curve meant, right? We knew what false positive negatives meant. All these things are mathematical, right? So we beat COVID using math and adjacent fields like stats and data science and all that. But you also at the same time saw this incredible, reserve towards that kind of logical, reasonable thinking. So math, I think generally people acknowledge that it's something that we need, that it's you know, a part of adding to the canon of human knowledge and, you know, pushing our knowledge in the direction of understanding how math works on some abstract level, even maybe. That's, I don't think people dispute that, but when it comes to actually using it to change the way we live, there's a little more resistance there.
And there are others, Ismail, again, you know this better than I do, who thinks there's too much math, or math has too much power. Another East European immigrant, Sergey Brin, brilliant mathematician, was the mathematical brain in the Brin-Page partnership that built Google. Math, of course, underpins AI. Is math now, even if it's not acknowledged, is it ubiquitous? Is it the thing driving AI, for example?
Oh, absolutely. It's absolutely ubiquitous. And math, right. So all the bad manifestations of math, or its their abuses, they're not because of math itself, right? They're because of people. But ubiquity is absolutely undeniable, right? We're entering the era of AI and quantum computing and, you know, cryptocurrency and all this. This is all based on very sophisticated and cool math. In fact, you mentioned Sergey Brin. So the thing that powers the Google PageRank algorithm, right, which is what Sergey Brin and what's the other guy's name?
Larry Page,
thank you, in the basement of a Stanford CS department, they realize PageRank algorithm works and it converges to give you ranking of the outputs after you put in a query, is a theorem from 1905 called the Perron-Frobenius theorem, which is a theorem in abstract mathematics, and that found this new life in this incredible application that is the PageRank algorithm. The reason we have encrypted communication on the internet is because of an Euler's theorem from 1730 something, right? So we mathematicians, we do this math because we love to do it, but we don't necessarily have any kind of application in mind. It is 100 or 300 years later that this amazing math finds a new life, for better or worse, right?
Right, and I think it was Brin who was the, as I said, he did all the math. Page did some of the computing science. Yeah. So it's interesting, as you suggest, that math is modernizing everything, AI and many other aspects of our society, but not politics. And that, of course, is the subject of your new book, which we're going to come to, Make Democracy Count. How Mathematics Improves Voting, Electoral Maps, and Representation, by Ismail Volich, the chair of the math department at Wellesley College. We're going to come back to that, Ismail, after the break. I want to thank our friends, though, before we talk more specifically about math and democracy. I want to thank our friends at Liberties, a quarterly journal of culture and politics, for helping us bring such amazing guests, as Ismail Volich, going to run a short feature on Liberties, and then we'll be back specifically to talk about how we can make democracy count. So don't go away, anyone. We need all of you to stay around.
Beyond the news, the noise, there is nuance, insight. Liberties is not just a journal of ideas. It's a meteor of intelligent substance. It's the place to be for engaged citizens. Politics, opinion, substance. Liberties is a triumph for freedom of thought. A quarterly of urgency, of cultural exploration, of intellectual delight, of immaculate prose. It's invaluable. Subscribe now or find Liberties at your favorite bookseller.
And you can subscribe to Liberties at libertiesjournal.com. We're speaking with Ismail Volich, mathematician at Wellesley College, the head of the Institute for Maths and Democracy at Wellesley, and the author of an important new book, Making Democracy Count, How Mathematics Improves Voting, Electoral Maps, and Representation. Ismail, is the current American electoral system, is it anti-math?
Well, it's sort of low-level math. I don't know if it's anti-math. It's mathematical. There's math in it, right? And by which I mean there are various processes that run on sort of mathematical algorithms, but most of them are based on very elementary and insufficient math.
So how can we use math, as you say in the subtitle of your book, to improve voting, electoral maps, and representation? does it do away, for example, with gerrymandering, which I think everybody, both on the left and right, acknowledge is doing huge damage to American democracy?
Right. So gerrymandering is one of the big topics in the math community these days. And there's some amazing, cool new work being done on sort of mathematically quantifying gerrymandering, right? So it's a notoriously difficult problem, as you can imagine, because maps are, you know, it's not just drawing borders on the, on the map. You know, there's demographic considerations, geography, history, laws like the Civil Rights Act and Voting Rights Act that have to be respected. So lots of factors come into map drawing. So the question is, how can you tell when a map is gerrymandered, and how do you recommend a map that is not? And this has really been one of the most prolific areas of applied math research in recent years. And it's cool because it combines data science and statistics and some fairly sophisticated math. So, the mathematicians have all these tools to tell when a map has been gerrymandered. What we've had more problems with is convincing the courts that this is legitimate. The courts are, you know, they're reflective of the general population's feeling towards math, which is, yeah, let's not do math. Okay, there's a wall that the population and the judiciary put up around them when they hear any kind of mathematical arguments. But that's changing, I think. There's this growing acceptance that we have something to say as far as map analysis goes. And I can get into the mathematical details if you want, but I'll let you.
Isma, last week, the Trump-Biden rematch was formalized. You mentioned you-know-who. We haven't talked about Biden. I'm guessing you're a professor in Massachusetts. You're probably on the left rather than the right. I'm guessing if you vote, you'd vote for Biden over Trump. There are conservatives who will argue that experts like you dress up your science to promote your own agendas. Is there any, maybe not so much in terms of your own work, but is there some truth to that, that some people simply are leveraging their own particular science or math to pursue their own political agendas?
Oh, I'm sure there are. I have tried. So you're right. I'm on one side of the political spectrum, but I have, you know, mathematicians in particular, scientists to some extent, but mathematicians in particular, we really have been trained carefully in sort of objective thinking, formalizing arguments. This is key, I think. We like to sort of set down a formal foundation for anything we're studying and sort of a axiomatic floor of the theory or anything we're developing or thinking about, and then build upon it in this like isolated axiomatic formal system. So we're really good at that. And therefore, we're, I think, good at distinguishing when we're operating in that framework and when we've stepped out of it. I have also honed this skill over the last few years. I've been teaching this math and politics class here at Wellesley College, which is really popular because, well, the topic is, you know, democracy and how to help it, how to salvage it almost. And it's this interdisciplinary thing that a lot of students at Wellesley and elsewhere are seeking out. So I've had to sort of learn, this was a new experience for me because the class contained all these elements in addition to math, history, politics, you know, demographic considerations, anthropology, and all that. So I had a hard time moderating discussions in the beginning. I didn't quite know how to not bring in my own personal views into the discussions, but I think I've managed to learn this over the last few years that I've done it. So I have made really, really extremely heartfelt efforts to remove myself from this book that I wrote. There are a lot of personal anecdotes from there, but more not political anecdotes. There's a lot of Bosnia, me being a refugee here, and sort of parallels between the two. There's a lot of, you know, what I see with my own children and what I see in the science community and what I see with my students, but just as a sort of a background context for the mathematics. I hope I've succeeded at sort of removing the bias from the mathematics itself. So stripping the math down to what it really is, unbiased, universal, you know, all-encompassing, nonpartisan, and all that.
Speaking of numbers, as everybody knows, Trump and Biden are both very old men. They're both over 80. They're part of the American gerontocracy, McConnell, Pelosi, and many other figures in Washington, D.C. seem to be part of this gerontocracy. In some ways, they're analogous, it seems, to the late Soviet gerontocracy around men like Brezhnev. Is there a connection between these old politicians who seem increasingly out of date and completely cut off from reality, Ismar, and the problems with American democracy? Is the sort of amathematical, shall we say, foundations of American democracy, do they lend itself to a gerontocratic elite of men like Trump and Biden?
They do. So first of all, a lot of our political algorithms of democracy support the duopoly. So the fact that we have two parties and it's that the bar is really high for anyone out not affiliated with these two behemoth parties, that's a consequence of many of the systems we have, including single winner congressional districts, plurality voting, first past the post, et cetera. So first of all, the duopoly issue could be somewhat resolved, not completely, but somewhat resolved with different mechanisms. Incumbent protection is another thing. So, you know, becoming a congressman or a senator is, you know, a cushy job that lasts for 30, 40 years, because once you're elected, it's very hard, again, because of these algorithms.
It's rather like a professor, isn't it?
Rather like a professor, except we work harder.
You get tenure. You work harder than Congress people and senators.
Absolutely. And there's another consequence, mathematical consequence, of the House that's stuck at 435 seats, that the Congress has become less and less productive over the decades. So yes, we work harder than, we accomplish more than the House, Congress people.
When you look at the American, sorry to interrupt here, because we need to get, we've got one or two more important points.
Sure.
When you look at the American electoral system, were there moments in the past where it looks as if that two-party system could be broken? And of course, there was the Perot, the Alabama governor in the 1960s. There was Teddy Roosevelt in the years before Bull Run, before the First World War. Were there moments where the two-party system was in jeopardy?
Well, there were instances in U.S. history when more than two parties existed in Congress, but somehow they always kind of fell away, and they always came back to these two. And you mentioned Ross Perot, right? So Perot won almost 20% of the popular vote in 1992, maybe?
It was the Clinton election where Clinton defeated the elder Bush.
That's right.
Clinton, and I think, was elected with around 40% of the vote.
So Clinton, the only state that Clinton had the majority, the actual majority of the votes in,
Massachusetts,
was Arkansas, his own home state.
Right.
So Ross Perot, meanwhile, won no electoral college seats, having won a fifth of the popular vote. So there's something, there's a mathematical.
Yeah, I mean, there is that. But then some people might come back and say, well, George Wallace ran quite strongly as almost a Confederate candidate in the 1960s. Do you want to reward a George Wallace with electoral college votes?
Why not? He wouldn't have won, right? But it would have sent a certain message. It would have set things up for maybe the next election, and would have maybe let the winning candidate know that certain segment of the population thought a certain way. In fact, Clinton did adopt some of the Ross Perot economic policies, if I remember correctly, because he could not ignore that 20% of the people voted for Perot. But what would happen with a different electoral system is more people would get engaged in the process. Again, the bar is so high that people just don't, there's no incentive for being a third party candidate or an alternate candidate from the same party. A lot of candidates are worried about being spoilers or causing the vote to split. You know, we talk about spoilers a lot, especially now with Robert Kennedy. And it's all the news, like, who is he's going to spoil right, the election Ralph, for, Biden or Trump?
I've had Ralph Nader on the show a couple of times. He's quite nice.
There you go, right? So,
many people on the left still haven't forgiven him for his spoiler right. role in the second Bush-Gore election. I want to end with ranked choice voting, which seems to be your model for improving democracy, for making it count. Are there, though, other countries, particularly in, I'm guessing, in Northern Europe, in Scandinavia, that do elections right? The German model is often cited. Are there countries that you look to, maybe Australia, Canada, where the math with democracy is working, where democracy really counts?
Right. So for single winner, if you have to have a single winner, like you're choosing a mayor or a governor or a president of the United States, I think we should be using ranked choice voting. And I say that, you know, my book, I go through all kinds of voting systems and I assess them and I explain them and I say, okay, if we had to pick one, I think really instant runoff is what we identify, what we equate with ranked choice voting. So this instant runoff method of tallying ranked votes is what I would choose to do. In countries that do that, it's very successful. We do it, so Australia, New Zealand, Scotland, Ireland, parts of Canada. We do ranked choice voting in a lot of places in the US at the local level, and two states do it, right? Alaska and Maine. And it's very successful. There really are no issues with it. So I think that's a system that works for single winner elections. That's what we should be using. When you mentioned Germany, so most of Europe and actually most democracies in the world have multi-member districts, meaning in a district, more than one candidate can be elected. And that I think is the right model for parliamentary elections. That allows for more parties to enter the contest and win some parliamentary seats. It encourages coalition building. It discourages negative campaigning. It actually prevents gerrymandering pretty much completely. So at the district level, I would change the system from single winner to multiple winner and use proportional representation. That's the sort of the buzzword associated with that. So there are, when you say electoral system, changing the electoral system, it really depends on the context. Are we picking one person or multiple people?
So just to end with RCV, your ranked choice voting. Let's imagine that you could click your fingers and the American system went from the Electoral College to RCV. What would that mean?
Well, it would mean ultimately that the will of the people, right, to use a kind of a tired phrase, but I don't know what else, how else to say it, would be more captured by this. And there's a simple reason why this is, without going into the details of how RCV works or how any more sophisticated voting methods work. The underlying principle is they ask for more information from the voter. And when you have more information from the voter about their preferences, math can do more with it and come up with a more optimal choice for a winner that has assessed the preferences of the voters in a better, more organized, more holistic way. That's really it. Plurality voting, you just go into the voting booth, you circle one person, and there's very little that math can do with that. There's very little input. You can't expect much from the output. In fact, you can expect that the output is going to be wrong much of the time, wrong according to some basic criteria of how we think elections should work and who should get elected. More information being put into the process means better mathematical assessment. That's really it.
It's funny, we talked about Google earlier, one of the central companies, and what many of our guests describe as surveillance capitalism. A lot of people are very uncomfortable with Google knowing so much more about us. But for you, you want the electoral system to know as much as they can about us, because that will create a better, a more efficient, and a more democratic political system. Is that correct? You want math to know more about us, or you want a system that will know more about us so that it can determine what we as citizens really want?
I do, but the scale of the information that would be taken in is much different for Google than this. All I mean by this is, you have an election, we should go into the booth being able to rank the candidates, not just our top choice, but also say who our second choice is, who our third and fourth, and, you know, down the list as far as we want to go. So that's the input that would be sufficient for these mathematically more sound voting systems like ranked choice voting to extract a winner from that information.
So what do you think, finally, this isn't going to happen, but imagine it did. The system got changed, and along with Trump and Biden, you had a lot of other candidates. Is it conceivable in a ranked choice voting system that a third or a fourth party candidate could win the presidential election in America?
Yeah, I think it is conceivable. Not, I mean, it would take some years for people to get used to this idea, but I think so. I mean, look at the dissatisfaction with Biden and Trump. If a reasonable centrist candidate presented themselves, not now, not maybe too late, but at some point, with ranked choice, they might actually have a reasonable chance. I mean, what's the, like, something like 70% of us are unsatisfied with either candidate, right? So given a solid center candidate who's not a lunatic, right, would actually in this environment might actually give them a really good chance at winning.